It still seems to be going very fast to me. And all of this must have happened before the Saletta. The thing is, Jessica said from her desk across the room, there isn't any competition at this point. Conditions are harsh, but these are very hardy plants, and when we put them out there, there isn't any competition to slow them down. It's an empty niche, Claire said. And conditions here are better than most places on Mars, Burkina added. In the south, you've got the aphelion winter and the high altitude. The stations down there report that the winter kill is just devastating. But here, the perihelion winter is a lot milder, and we're only a kilometer high. It's pretty benign, really. Better than Antarctica in many ways. Especially in the CO2 level, Burkina said. I wonder if that doesn't account for some of that speed you're talking about. It's like the plants are being supercharged. Ah, Sack said, nodding. So the fell fields were gardens. Aided growth rather than natural growth. He had known that, of course. It was a given everywhere on Mars. But the fell fields, so rocky and diffuse, had looked spontaneous and wild enough to momentarily confuse him. And even remembering they were gardens, he was still surprised that they were so vigorous. Well, and now with this Saletta pouring sunlight onto the surface, Jessica exclaimed. She shook her head as if disapproving. Natural insolation averaged 45% of Earth's, and with the Saletta it's supposed to be up to 54. Tell me more about the Saletta, Sack said carefully. They told him in a kind of round. A group of transnationals, led by Subarashi, had built a circular slatted array of solar sail mirrors placed between the Sun and Mars and aligned to focus inward sunlight that would have just missed the planet. An annular support mirror, rotating in a polar orbit, reflected light back to the Saletta to counterbalance the pressure of the sunlight, and that light was bounced back onto Mars as well. Both these mirror systems were truly huge compared to the early freighter sails Sachs had enlisted to reflect light onto the surface, and the reflected light they were adding to the system was really significant. It must have cost a fortune to build them, Sachs murmured. Oh, it did! The big transnats are investing like you can't believe! And they're not done yet, Burkina said. They're planning to fly an aerial lens just a few hundred kilometers above the surface, and this lens will focus some of the incoming light from the Saletta until it heats the surface up to fantastic temperatures, like 5,000 degrees. 5,000? Yes, I think that's what I heard. They plan to melt the sand and the regolith underneath, which will release all the volatiles into the atmosphere. But what about the surface? They plan to do it in remote areas. In lines, Claire said, so that they end up with ditches. Canals, Sack said. Yes, that's right, they laughed. Glass-sided canals, Sack said, troubled by the thought of all those volatiles. Carbon dioxide would be prominent among them, perhaps chief among them. But he didn't want to show too much interest in the larger terraforming issues. He let it go, and soon enough the talk returned to their work. Well, Sack said, I guess some of the fell fields will turn into alpine meadows pretty soon.
Oh, they're already there, Claire said.
Really?
Yes, well, they're small. But hike down the western edge about 3 kilometers. Have you done that yet? You'll see. Alpine meadows and Krumholtz, too. It hasn't been that difficult. We planted trees without even altering them very much, because a lot of spruce and pine species turned out to have temperature tolerances much lower than they needed in their Terran habitats.
That's peculiar.
A holdover from the ice ages, I guess. But now it's coming in handy.
Interesting, Sack said.
And he spent the rest of that day staring into the microscopes without seeing a thing, lost in thought.
Life is so much spirit, Hiroko used to say. It was a very strange business, the vigor of living things, their tendency to proliferate, what Hiroko called their green surge, their viriditas, a striving toward pattern. It made him so curious.
When dawn arrived the next day, he woke up in Phyllis's bed, with Phyllis tangled in the sheets beside him. After dinner, the whole group had retired to the observation room, as was becoming habitual, and Sachs had continued the conversation with Claire and Jessica and Burkina, and Jessica had been very friendly to him, as was her wont, and Phyllis had seen this and had followed him to the bathrooms by the elevator and pounced on him with that shocking seductive embrace of hers, and they had ended up going down to the dorm floor and to her room. And although Sachs had felt uncomfortable about disappearing without saying good night to the others, he had made love to her passionately enough. Now, looking at her, he remembered their precipitate departure with distaste. It didn't take any more than the most simple-minded sociobiology to explain such behavior, competition for mates, a very basic animal activity. Of course, Sachs had never been the subject of such competition before, but there was nothing to pride oneself on in this sudden manifestation. Clearly it was happening because of Vlad's cosmetic surgery, which through some chance had rearranged his face into a configuration appealing to women. Although why one arrangement of facial features should be more attractive than another was a total mystery to him. He had heard sociobiological explanations of sexual attractiveness before, and he could see that some of them might have some validity. A man would look for a mate with wide hips to be able safely to give birth to his children, with significant breasts in order to feed his children, etc. A woman would look for a strong man to feed her children and to father strong children, etc., etc. That made a kind of sense. But none of it had anything to do with facial features. For them, sociobiological explanations got pretty tenuous. Wide-set eyes for good eyesight, good teeth to aid health, a significant nose to avoid getting colds. No, it just wasn't as sensible as that. It was a matter of chance configurations somehow appealing to the eye. An aesthetic judgment in which tiny non-functional features could make a great difference, which indicated that practical concerns were not a factor. A case in point was a pair of twin sisters with whom Sachs had gone to high school. They had been identical twins and had looked very much alike, and yet somehow one had been plain while the other had been beautiful. No, it was a matter of millimeters of flesh and bone and cartilage accidentally falling into patterns that pleased or did not. So Vlad had made some alterations to his face, and now women were competing for his attentions, though he was the same person he had always been. A person Phyllis had never shown the slightest interest in before, when he had looked the way nature had made him. It was hard not to be somewhat cynical about it. To be wanted, yes, but wanted for trivialities. He got out of bed and suited up in one of the latest lightweight suits, so much more comfortable than the old stretch fabric walkers. One had to insulate against the sub-freezing temperatures, and wear a helmet and air tank, of course, but there was no longer any need to provide pressure to avoid bruising of the skin. Even 160 millibars was enough for that, and so now it was only a matter of warm clothing and boots and the helmet. So it only took a few minutes to dress, and then he was out to the glacier again. He crunched over the hoarfrost on the main flag trail across the river of ice, and then wound downstream on the western bank, passing the little Millefleur fell fields coated with frost that was already beginning to melt in the light. He came to a place where the glacier dropped down a small escarpment in a short, crazed icefall. It also took a few degrees turn to the left, following its bordering ribs. Suddenly a loud creak filled the air, followed by a low-frequency boom that vibrated in his stomach. The ice was moving. He stopped, listening. He heard the distant bell sound of an under-ice stream. He hiked on, feeling lighter and happier with every step. The morning light was very clear, the steam on the ice like white smoke. And then, in the shelter of some huge boulders, he came upon an amphitheater of fell field, dotted with flowers like flecks of paint. And at the bottom of the field was a little alpine meadow, south-facing and shockingly green, the mats of grass and sedge all cut with ice-coated watercourses. And around the edges of the amphitheater, sheltered in cracks and under rocks, hunched a number of dwarf trees. It was Krumholtz, then, which in the evolution of mountain landscapes was the next stage after alpine meadows. The dwarf trees he had spotted were actually members of ordinary species, mostly white spruce. Picea glauca, which in these harsh conditions miniaturized on their own, contouring into the protected spaces they sprouted in, or had been planted in, more likely. Sack saw some lodgepole pine, Pinus contorta, joining the more numerous white spruce. These were the most cold-tolerant trees on Earth, and apparently the biotique team had added salt tolerance from trees like the tamarisks. All kinds of engineering had been done to aid them, and yet still the extreme conditions stunted their growth, until trees that might have grown 30 meters high crouched in little knee-high pockets of protection, sheared off by winds and winter snowpacks as if by hedge clippers. Thus the name Krumholtz, German for crooked wood, or perhaps elfin wood, the zone where trees first managed to take advantage of the soil-building work of fell fields and alpine meadows. Tree limit. Sax wandered slowly around the amphitheater, stepping on rocks, inspecting the mosses, the sedges, the grasses, and every single individual tree. The gnarly little things were twisted as if cultivated by deranged bonsai gardeners. "Oh, how nice," he said out loud more than once, inspecting a branch or a trunk or a pattern of laminate bark, peeling away like phyllo dough. "Oh, how nice. Oh, for some moles and voles, and marmots and minxes and foxes." But the CO2 in the atmosphere was still nearly 30% of the air, perhaps 50 millibars all by itself. All mammals would die very quickly in such air. This was why he had always resisted the two-stage terraforming model, which called for a massive CO2 buildup to precede anything else, as if warming the planet were the only goal. But warming was not the goal. Animals on the surface was the goal. This was not only a good in itself, but good also for the plants, many of which needed animals. Most of these fell field plants propagated on their own, of course, and there were some altered insects that Biotique had released, out there bumbling around in stubborn insect survivalist mode, half alive and only just managing their work of pollination. But there were many other symbiotic ecological functions that needed animals, like the soil aeration accomplished by moles and voles, or the spread of seeds by birds, and without them plants could not thrive, and some wouldn't live at all. No, they needed to reduce the CO2 in the air, probably right back to the 10 millibars it had been when they arrived, when it had been the only air there was. Which was why the plan his colleagues had mentioned to melt the regolith with an aerial lens was so troubling. It would only increase their problem. Meanwhile, this unexpected beauty. Hours passed as he inspected specimens one by one, admiring in particular the spiraling trunk and branches, the flaking bark and sprays of needles of one little lodgepole pine, like a piece of flamboyant sculpture, really. And he was down on his knees with his face in a sedge and his butt in the air when Phyllis and Claire and a whole group came trooping down into the meadow, laughing at him and trampling carelessly on the living grass. Phyllis stayed with him that afternoon, as she had one or two times before, and they walked back together, Sax trying at first to play the role of native guide, pointing out plants he had just learned the previous week. But Phyllis asked no questions about them, and didn't appear even to listen when he spoke. It seemed she only wanted him to be an audience to her, a witness to her life. So he gave up on the plants and asked questions, and listened and then asked more. It was a good opportunity to learn more about the current Martian power structure, after all. Even if she exaggerated her own role in it, it was still informative. "I was amazed how fast Tsubarashi got the new elevator built and into position," she said.
"Tsubarashi?"
"They were the principal contractor."
"Who awarded the contract, Yunoma?"
"Oh, no. Yunoma has been replaced by the UN Transitional Authority." So when you were president of the Transitional Authority, you were in effect president of Mars. Well, the presidency just rotates among the members. It doesn't confer much more power than any other members have. It's just for media consumption and to run the meetings. Scut work. Still. Oh, I know, she laughed. It's a position a lot of my old colleagues wanted but never got. Chalmers, Bogdanov, Boone, Toitovna. I wonder what they would have thought if they had seen it. But they backed the wrong horse. Sachs looked away from her. So why did Subarashi get the new elevator? The steering committee of the TA voted that way. Praxis had made a bid for it, and no one likes Praxis. Now that the elevator is back, do you think things will change again? Oh, certainly, certainly. A lot of things have been on hold since the unrest. Emigration, building, terraforming, commerce, they've all been slowed down. We've barely managed to rebuild some of the damaged towns. It's been a kind of martial law, necessary, of course, given what happened. Of course. But now, all the stockpiled metals from the last 40 years are ready to enter the Terran market, and that's going to stimulate the entire two-world economy unbelievably. We'll see more production out of Earth now, and more investment here, more emigration, too. We're finally ready to get on with things.
Like the Saleta?
Exactly. That's a perfect example of what I mean. There's all kinds of plans for major investment here.
Glass-sided canals, Sachs said. It would make the moholes look trivial.
Phyllis was saying something about how bright things looked for Earth, and he shook his head to clear it of joules per square centimeter, he said. But I thought Earth had some serious difficulties. Oh, Earth always has serious difficulties. We're going to have to get used to that. No, I'm very optimistic. I mean, this recession has hit them hard down there, especially the little tigers and the baby tigers, and, of course, the less developed countries. But the influx of industrial metals from here will stimulate the economy for everyone, including the environment control industries. And, unfortunately, it looks like the diebacks will solve a lot of their other problems for them.
Sachs focused on the section of moraine they were climbing. Here, solifluction, the daily melting of ground ice on a tilt, had caused the loose regolith to slide down in a series of dips and rims, and although it all looked gray and lifeless, a faint pattern like minuscule tiling revealed that it was actually covered with blue-gray flake lichen. In the dips, there were clumps of what looked like gray ash, and Sachs stooped to pluck a small sample.
Look, he said brusquely to Phyllis. Snow liverwort. It looks like dirt.
That's a parasitic fungus that grows on it. The plant is actually green. See those little leaves? That's new growth that the fungus hasn't covered yet. Under magnification, the new leaves look like green glass, but Phyllis didn't bother to look.
Who designed that one?
She asked, her tone of voice implying that the designer had poor taste.
I don't know. Could be no one. Quite a few of the new species out here weren't designed.
Can evolution be working so fast?
Well, you know, is polyploidy evolution?
No. Phyllis moved on, not much interested in the gray little specimen. Snow liverwort. Probably very lightly engineered or even undesigned. Test specimens cast out here among the rest to see how they would do, and thus very interesting in Sachs's opinion. But somewhere along the way, Phyllis had lost interest. She had been a first-rate biologist once, and Sachs found it hard to imagine losing the curiosity which lay at the core of science, that urge to figure things out. But they were getting old. In the course of their, now, unnatural lives, it was likely they would all change, perhaps profoundly. Sachs didn't like the idea, but there it was. Like all the rest of the new centenarians, he was having more and more trouble remembering specifics from his past, especially the middle years, things that had happened between the ages of around 25 to 90. Thus, the years before 61, and most of his years on Earth, were getting dim. And without fully functioning memories, they were certain to change.
So when they returned to the station, he went to the lab, disturbed. Perhaps, he thought, they had gone polyploidal, not as individuals, but culturally. An international array arriving here and effectively quadrupling the meme strands, providing the adaptability to survive in this alien terrain despite all the stress-induced mutations. But no, that was analogy rather than homology. What in the humanities they would call a heroic simile, if he understood the term, or a metaphor, or some other kind of literary analogy. And analogies were mostly meaningless. A matter of phenotype rather than genotype, to use another analogy. Most of poetry and literature, really all the humanities, not to mention the social sciences, were phenotypic as far as Sachs could tell. They added up to a huge compendium of meaningless analogies which didn't help to explain things but only distorted perception of them. A kind of continuous conceptual drunkenness, one might say. Sachs himself much preferred exactitude and explanatory power, and why not? If it was 200 Kelvin outside, why not say so rather than talk about witches' tits and the like, hauling the whole great baggage of the ignorant past along to obscure every encounter with sensory reality? It was absurd. So, okay, there was no such thing as cultural polyploidy. There was just a determinant historical situation, the consequence of all that had come before, the decisions made, the results spreading out over the planet in complete disarray, evolving, or one should say developing, without a plan. Planless. In that regard, there was a similarity between history and evolution in that both of them were matters of contingency and accident, as well as patterns of development. But the differences, particularly in timescales, were so gross as to make that similarity nothing more than analogy again. No, better to concentrate on homologies, those structural similarities that indicated actual physical relationships that really explained something. This, of course, took one back into science. But after an encounter with Phyllis, that was just what he wanted. So he dove back into studying plants. Many of the fell-field organisms he was finding had hairy leaves and very thick leaf surfaces, which helped protect the plants from the harsh UV blast of Martian sunlight. These adaptations could very well be examples of homologies in which species with the same ancestors had all kept family traits. Or they could be examples of convergence, in which species from separate phyla had come to the same forms through functional necessity. And these days they could also be simply the result of bioengineering, the breeders adding the same traits to different plants in order to provide the same advantages. Finding out which it was required identifying the plant and then checking the records to see if it had been designed by one of the terraforming teams. There was a biotique lab in Elysium led by a Harry Whitebook, designing many of the most successful surface plants, especially the sedges and grasses, and a check in the Whitebook catalog often showed that his hand had been at work, in which case the similarities were often a matter of artificial convergence, Whitebook inserting traits like hairy leaves into almost every leaved plant he bred. An interesting case of history imitating evolution. And certainly since they wanted to create a biosphere on Mars in a short time, perhaps 10^7 times quicker than it had taken on Earth, they would have to intervene continuously in the act of evolution itself. So the Martian biosphere wouldn't be a case of phylogeny recapitulating ontogeny, a discredited notion in any case, but of history recapitulating evolution, or rather, imitating it to the extent possible given the Martian environment, or even directing it. History directing evolution. It was a daunting thought. Whitebook was going about the task with a lot of flair. He had bred phreatophytic lichen reefs, for instance, which built the salts they incorporated into a kind of millipore coral structure, so that the resulting plants were olive or dark green masses of semi-crystalline blocks. Walking through a patch of them was like walking through a Lilliputian garden maze which had been crushed, abandoned, and half covered with sand. The individual blocks of the plant were fractured or fissured in a crackle pattern, and they were so lumpish they looked diseased, with a disease that appeared to petrify plants while they were still living, leaving them struggling to exist inside broken sheaths of malachite and jade. Strange-looking, but very successful. Sachs found quite a few of these lichen reefs growing on the crest of the western moraine rib and in the more arid regolith beyond. He spent a few mornings studying them there, and one morning crossing the ridge he looked back over the glacier and saw a sandy whirlwind spinning over the ice, a sparkling rust-colored little tornado that rushed downstream. Immediately afterward he was struck by a high wind with gusts of at least 100 kilometers an hour and then 150. He ended up crouching behind a lichen reef, lifting a hand to try to estimate the wind speed. It was hard to make an accurate guess because the thickening atmosphere had increased the force of winds, making them seem faster than they really were. All estimates based on the instincts from the Underhill days were now badly off. The gusts striking him now might have been as slow as 80 kilometers an hour, but full of sand, ticking against his faceplate and reducing visibility to 100 meters or so. After an hour of waiting for the sandstorm to decrease, he gave up and returned to the station, crossing the glacier by moving very carefully from flag to flag, careful not to lose the trail they made, important if one wanted to stay out of dangerous crevasse zones. Once across the ice, Sachs made his way back to the station quickly, pondering the little tornado that had announced the arrival of the wind. Weather was strange. Inside, he called up the meteorology channel and ran through all its information on the day's weather and then stared at a satellite photo of their region. A cyclonic cell was bearing down on them from Tharsis. With the air thickening, the winds coming off Tharsis were powerful indeed. The bulge would forever remain an anchoring point in Martian climatology, Sachs suspected. Most of the time, the northern hemisphere jet stream would circle up and around its northern end, like Terra's northern jet stream did around the Rockies. But every once in a while, air masses would shove over the Tharsis crest between volcanoes, dropping their moisture on West Tharsis as they rose. Then these dehydrated air masses would roar down the eastern slope, Big Man's Mistral, or Sirocco, or Fane, with winds so fast and forceful that as the atmosphere thickened they were getting to be a problem. Some tent towns on the open surface were endangered to the point where it looked like they might have to retreat into craters or canyons, or at least greatly strengthen their tenting. As Sachs considered it, the whole issue of weather became so exciting that he wanted to drop his botanical studies and go after it full time. In the old days he would have done that and dived into climatology for a month or a year until his curiosity was satisfied, and he had managed to think of some contribution to policy regarding any problems that were arising. But that had been a rather undisciplined approach, as he now saw, leading to a kind of scattershot method, even to a certain dilettantism. Now, as Stephen Lindholm, working for Claire and Biotique, he had to abandon climatology with a longing glance at the satellite photos and their suggestively swirling new cloud systems, and merely tell the others about the whirlwind and talk about weather in a recreational way in the lab or over dinner, while his main effort returned to their little ecosystem and its plants and how to help them along. And as he was just beginning to feel he was learning the particularities of Arena, these restrictions imposed by his new identity were not a bad thing. They meant he was forced to concentrate on a single discipline in a way he hadn't since his post-doc work, and the rewards of concentration were becoming more and more evident to him. They could make him a better scientist. The next day, for instance, with the winds merely brisk, he went back out and located the coral lichen patch he had been investigating when the sandstorm had hit. All the structure's fissures were filled with sand, which must have been true most of the time. So he brushed one of the fissures clean and looked inside through the 20-power magnifiers on his faceplate. The walls of the fissures were coated with very fine cilia, somewhat like the tiny versions of the hairs on exposed leaves of alpine cinquefoil. Clearly, there was no need for protection of these already well-hidden surfaces. Perhaps they were there to release excess oxygen from the tissues of the semi-crystalline outside mass, spontaneous or planned. He read through descriptions on his wrist and added a new one of this specimen, which, because of the cilia, appeared to be nondescript. He took out a little camera from his thigh pocket and took a picture, put a sample of the cilia in a bag, and put both camera and bag in his thigh pocket, and moved on. He went down to look at the glacier, stepping onto it at one of the many junctures where its side came down and met smoothly the rising slope of the moraine rib. It was bright on the glacier at midday, as if bits of broken mirror were reflecting sunlight everywhere on it. Chunks of ice crunched underfoot. Little watersheds gathered to deep-channeled streams, which abruptly disappeared down holes in the ice. These holes, like the crevasses, were various shades of blue. The moraine ribs gleamed like gold and seemed to bounce in the rising heat. Something in the sight reminded Sax of the Saleta plan, and he whistled through his teeth. He straightened up and stretched his lower back, feeling very alive and curious, absolutely in his element. The scientist at work. He was learning to like the ever-fresh primary effort of natural history, its close observation of things in nature, description, categorization, taxonomy. The primal attempt to explain, or rather its first step, simply to describe. How happy the natural historians had always seemed to him in their writings, Linnaeus and his wild Latin, Lyell and his rocks, Wallace and Darwin and their great step from category to theory, from observation to paradigm. Sax could feel it right there on Arena Glacier in the year 2101, with all these new species, this flourishing process of speciation that was half human and half Martian, a process that would need its own theories eventually, some kind of evo-history, or historico-evolution, or ecopoesis, or simply areology. Or Hirokos Veriditas, perhaps. Theories of the terraforming project, not only in what it intended, but how it was actually working. A natural history, precisely. Very little of what was happening could be studied with experimental lab science, so natural history was going to return to its proper place among the sciences as one among equals. Here on Mars, all kinds of hierarchies were destined to fall, and that was no meaningless analogy, but simply a precise observation of what all could see. What all could see. Would he have understood before his time out here? Would Anne understand? Looking down the wild, cracked surface of the glacier, he found himself thinking of her. Every little berg and crevasse stood out as if he still had the 20-power magnification on his faceplate, but with an infinite depth of field. Every tint of ivory and pink in the pock surfaces, every mirror gleam of meltwater, the bumpy hillocks of the far horizon, everything was, for the moment, surgically clear and focused. And it occurred to him that this vision was not a matter of accident, the lensing of tears over his cornea, for instance, but the result of a new and growing conceptual understanding of the landscape. It was a kind of cognitive vision, and he couldn't help but remember Anne saying angrily to him, "Mars is the place you have never seen." He had taken it as a figure of speech. But now he recalled Kuhn asserting that scientists who used different paradigms existed in literally different worlds, epistemology being such an integral component of reality. Thus, Aristotelians simply did not see the Galilean pendulum, which to them was a body falling with some difficulty, and, in general, scientists debating the relative merits of competing paradigms simply talked right through each other, using the same words to discuss different realities. He had considered that, too, to be a figure of speech. But thinking of it now, absorbing the hallucinatory clarity of the ice, he had to admit that it certainly described what his conversations with Anne had always felt like. It had been a frustration to both of them, and when Anne had cried out that he had never seen Mars, a statement that was obviously false on some levels, she had perhaps meant only to say that he hadn't seen her Mars, the Mars created by her paradigm, and that was no doubt true. Now, however, he was seeing a Mars he had never seen before. But the transformation had come by focusing for a matter of weeks on just those parts of the Martian landscape that Anne despised, the new life forms. So he doubted that the Mars he was seeing, with its snow algae and ice lichen, and the enchanting little patches of Persian carpet fringing the glacier, was Anne's Mars. Nor was it the Mars of his colleagues in terraforming. It was a function of what he believed and what he wanted. It was his Mars, evolving right before his very eyes, always in the process of becoming something new. Like a stab to the heart, he felt the wish that he could seize Anne at that very moment and pull her by the arm down the western moraine, crying, "See? See? See?" Instead, he had Phyllis, perhaps the least philosophical person he had ever known. He avoided her when he could do it without appearing to, and passed his days on the ice, in the wind under the vast northern sky, or on the moraines, crawling around studying plants. Back in the station, he talked over dinner with Claire and Burkina and the rest about what they were finding out there and what it meant. After dinner, they retired to the observation room and talked some more, dancing on some nights, especially Fridays and Saturdays. The music they played was always Nuevo Calypso, guitars and steel drums in fast, simultaneous melodies, creating complex rhythms that Sax had great difficulty analyzing. They were often measures of 5-4 time alternating or even coexisting with 4-4, a pattern seemingly designed to throw him out of step. Luckily, the current dance style was a kind of free-form movement that had little relation to the beat anyway, so when he failed in his attempts to stay in rhythm, he was pretty sure he was the only one who noticed. In fact, it made a pretty good entertainment just trying to keep time, off on his own, hopping around with a little jig added to the 5-4 measures. When he returned to the tables and Jessica said to him, "You're really a good dancer, Stephen." He burst out laughing, pleased even though he knew all it revealed was Jessica's incompetence to judge dance or her attempt to please him, although perhaps the daily boulder walking in the field was improving his balance and timing. Any physical action, properly studied and practiced, could no doubt be accomplished with a reasonable amount of skill, if not flair. He and Phyllis talked or danced together only as much as they did with everyone else, and only in the secrecy of their rooms did they embrace, kiss, make love. It was the old pattern of the hidden affair, and one morning around 4 a.m. returning to his room from hers, a flash of fear shook him. It seemed to him suddenly that his immediate undiscussed complicity in this behavior must tag him to Phyllis as suspiciously like one of the first 100. Who else would fall into such a bizarre pattern so readily, as if it were the natural thing to do? But on consideration, it didn't seem that Phyllis was attentive to nuances of that kind. Sax had almost given up trying to understand her thinking and her motivations, as the data were contradictory and, despite the fact that they were spending nights together on a fairly regular basis, rather sparse. She seemed interested mostly in the intertransnational maneuvering that was going on in Sheffield and back on Earth, shifts in executive personnel and subsidiaries and stock prices that were clearly ephemeral and meaningless, but to her, utterly absorbing. As Stephen, he remained brightly interested in all this and asked her questions about it to show his interest when she brought it up. But when he asked about what the daily changes meant in any larger strategic sense, she was either unable or unwilling to give him good answers. Apparently it was interesting to her more for the personal fortunes of those she knew than for the system that their careers revealed. An ex-Consolidated executive, now with Tsuburashi, had been made head of elevator operations. A Praxis executive had disappeared in the outback. Armscor was going to explode scores of hydrogen bombs in the mega regolith under the North Polar Cap to stimulate growth and warming of the Northern Sea, and this last fact was no more interesting to her than the two previous ones. And perhaps it made sense to pay attention to the individual careers of the people running the biggest transnationals and the micropolitics of the jockeying for power among them. These were the current rulers of the world, after all. So Sachs lay next to Phyllis, listening to her and making Stephen's comments, trying to sort out all the names, wondering if the founder of Praxis really was a senile surfer, wondering if Shalalko would be taken over by Amex, wondering why the Transnat executive teams were so fiercely competitive, given that they already ruled the world and had everything they could conceivably want in their personal lives. Perhaps sociobiology indeed had the answer, and it was all primate dominance dynamics, a matter of increasing one's reproductive success in the corporate realm, which might not be a mere analogy if one considered one's company as one's kin. And then again, in a world where one might live indefinitely, it could be simple self-protection. Survival of the fittest, which Sachs had always considered a useless tautology. But if social Darwinists were taking over, then maybe the concept gained importance as a religious dogma of the ruling order. And then Phyllis would roll over onto him and kiss him, and he would enter the realm of sex, where different rules seemed to obtain. For instance, though he liked Phyllis less and less as he got to know her better, his attraction to her did not correlate to this, but fluctuated according to mysterious principles of its own, no doubt pheromone-driven and hormonally based, so that sometimes he had to steel himself to accept her touches, while other times he felt alive with a lust that seemed all the stronger because it was so unmixed with affection, or, more senseless still, a lust actually heightened by dislike. This last reaction was rare, however, and as the stay at Arena went on, and the novelty of their affair wore off, Sachs more and more frequently found himself distanced from their lovemaking and inclined to fantasize during it and fall very deeply into Stephen Lindholm, who appeared to be thinking about caressing women Sachs didn't know or had scarcely heard of, like Ingrid Bergman or Marilyn Monroe.
This ends side 2 of cassette 6 of Green Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 7.